This morning, you guys, we want to jump into our series. We want to just kind of be normal again, okay? So we're just going to jump into our series. Next week for the dedication, we've invited a lot of the people who have worked on the building. In fact, I meant to do that. I didn't anticipate that some of the people who had helped us beyond us, contractors, but we invited them for next week, but some of them came this week. And so we're just so glad that they're here. So the guys who did the plumbing are here. Guys who did the windows are here. There are probably others I don't even know. And we're just so grateful. And so we hope they can come back next week and we'll just acknowledge it a little bit even better. But so this summer we're going to spend a series, and we're going to call it Who Are You? And now, that's a pretty critical question. It's a pretty basic question. It's a very human question. It really is the basis of the question, the fundamental question of St. Louis. You know the fundamental question of St. Louis? What high school did you go to? You know, because that's trying to figure out who you are, right? We ask, where'd you go to high school? And all of a sudden they say, well, I went to Vianney. And we go, oh, Jake, you went to Vianney. So what do we know about Jake? Because Jake went to Vianney. Well, we know a few things. And we won't talk about exactly what we know about Jake. because of that. Or, hey, I went to Hazelwood East. That's where my wife went to school. And so you know a ton of things about Diane just because you know where she went to high school. It's kind of the fundamental question. You know, who are you is what we're asking, right? The unique thing is this question really tries to determine identity when we ask, who are you? We want to know a little bit about you. And so it's all about identity. But at the end of the day, this is really a question about trustworthiness, isn't it? When we really ask the question, who are you? We want to try to determine if I can trust you. And that's what it's all about. And so it seems to me that that's the fundamental question that we ask on a horizontal level, and it's a very human-centered question. But I think there's a question that we ought to ask that it's a much more vertical question, and it's a question that we ask of God. Who are you, God? We want to know his identity. We want to know if he's trustworthy, right? And it's not a question that we ask very much anymore. It seems to me that we don't ask it because God has become more distant and seemingly more irrelevant to our lives. And we seldom ask that question, God, who are you really? Really? I've got to face this. I just did a wedding yesterday in the sanctuary. I wish it was here because the sanctuary was 91 degrees during the wedding. It was like brutal, you know, and I skipped almost everything I was going to say because we're all about to drop like flies, you know, and we're like, okay, we got to get to the reception because it's going to be air conditioned. But the couple that I did, I had kind of grown up in church backgrounds, but when they got to college, they kind of bailed on the whole thing. And then since that, they've kind of slowly become more interested. And so when they asked me to do their wedding, they said, we would like to talk part of the time about who is God and how do I connect? Because we're not really sure from our backgrounds how to translate that. We kind of didn't care. He became very distant and irrelevant to them. But he's becoming more relevant to them and beginning to ask the question. And so during our time, our premarital times, they would about halfway through each session, they'd say, okay, that's great. Hey, I got a question about God. Can we talk about him? And I'm like, well, okay, that's cool. It doesn't happen very often. And so we would talk about God for the next, you know, 45 minutes or so. And begin to wrestle with different questions about how he relates to life. And it was just so enjoyable and so cool. But it seems to me that when we begin to ask, who are you? We need an answer. And it seems to me that if we do this, that I wanted to start in the book of Exodus, chapter 3. So we're going to go there in Exodus, and this is an interaction that a guy named Moses is going to have with God. Now, let me just give you a little bit of a thought about this. Well, in fact, let's just go to verse 1, and then we'll go from there. It says, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro. So we have this guy named Moses. He's out being a shepherd, and his father-in-law, who he's working for, is named Jethro, and he's a priest or a leader of the clan in the area called Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, what's called, now knowing, the mountain of God. Now, just so you know, there are 66 books in the Bible. There should be 67 because the 67th book is the book of maps. I love the book of maps. So you got to wonder, okay, where's Midian? Where's Horeb? You know, what's all that do? And now we're in a room where we can put it out a map again. I love this room because we can do maps. Okay, so let's go to the book of maps here. We're going to find out. Now, so in this map, what we've got over here, and so you guys over here are going to be Egypt, okay? You're Egypt. And this is the Gulf of Suez, and it dumps into the Red Sea back there, okay? Now, you guys are going to be the Sinai, okay? So you're the Sinai. Now, if you've ever been to the Sinai, it is a desolate, desolate place. It is not very enjoyable. But you guys will make it look better, okay? It's the Sinai, but way up, there's a place called the Gulf of Suez. This is the Gulf of Agaba, and so the Sinai sits in between. It's way up north. So you guys are then going to be the Arabian Peninsula, okay? You guys are pretty cool. The Persian Gulf is going to be over here, and then way over here is going to be Iraq. And we're going to find out what happens here, because Moses is this man who is, his life was saved as a little baby. He's a Hebrew. And his life is saved by his mother putting him in a little basket and floating him in the river because the Egyptians wanted to kill all of the Hebrew little boys because they were becoming so numerous, they said, we've got to kill all the boys. And so they said, okay, kill all those guys. But the mother didn't want to do it, so she floated him in a river in a little basket, and one of the members of Pharaoh's home found him and raised him as part of the family of Pharaoh. He was in a very favored place, though he was a Hebrew, and he knew he was a Hebrew, and everyone knew he was a Hebrew, but he was in a very favored place. Then one day, when he was out watching the work that the Hebrews were doing, they'd become a slave population, if you will. They were oppressed, they were downtrodden, and he was out, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And so Moses stepped in, looked around, no one was watching, and he killed the Egyptian. Then later he found two Hebrews fighting, and he stepped in to make a difference. He stepped in to make them stop. And they stepped back and they said, oh, you're going to kill us too? And all of a sudden he knew that he'd been found out. And so Moses escapes. He runs. He's a fugitive from justice. This happens when he's about 40 years old. And for the next 40 years, he hung out in the area of Midian. If you look on the map, it's way over here. It's in the area of Midian. And he hung out there. And it says, well, let's go to verse 2, and we'll see what it has to say. Oh, yeah, so when we talk about, I'm sorry, we had, let's go back. Where's this mountain of Horeb? We don't really actually know for sure. One of the places, yeah, let's go back even to several more. I'm sorry, I got way out of whack. Some think it's in the southern Sinai. Others think it's in the area of Midian over to the right. We don't know for sure where it's at. It was a long time ago. It's one of the two places. Probably doesn't totally matter to us now. But in modern day map, let's go forward just one. Modern day, that's what we're looking at. It's up in the northern part of what's now Egypt and part of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And so this is the two places where we think that mountain probably was, where Moses ends up. Now, let's go to verse 2. It says this. Now, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. So Moses said, I think I'm going to turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. I probably would do the same, right? I mean, if you saw a bush burning, but it wasn't burning up, you would probably tend to say, I think I'm going to check that out. You know, that's very interesting. Many years ago, Diane and I were the Campus Crusade directors at the University of Southern California, and we took students on a spring break, and we went to a large lake outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. And it was this huge lake, but it was cold. But one day we took a boat out in the middle of the lake, and it was dark. It was at night. We just thought we'd go out and see. And we looked back towards our campground, and all of a sudden there were these flames shooting up out of the, just like crazy. And we thought, what in the world? And it would shoot up, and it would burn for just a few minutes, and then it would be gone. And then another one. Whew, and then another one. And I thought, I think I better get back and figure out what's going on there. And so we go back, and the students, we had all this white kerosene, this white gas, and they were pouring it on these huge bushes. These bushes were about 12, 15 feet tall. They're very dry. We're out in the desert. And they were pouring this white gas on this stuff and lighting it. And it would go up like a torch, just whoo, and then it would destroy it. But what happened here is it was burning, and it didn't get destroyed. The bush never burned. And so it says here that Moses turned aside to see this thing. And then in verse 4, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, when Moses began to engage this unexplainable thing, God engaged him. He says, and he said, God called him out of the bush. He said twice, Moses, Moses. Now, would that freak you out just a titch? If your name was called out of the bush? That, okay, I mean, I'm headed for the, you know, for the gates at that point. But Moses, Moses, and he said, in Moses' response, here I am. He's like, okay. Now, you guys, let's get the picture here. Sometimes we read back into this story all the things that happened later of what God did, but let's face what happened. Moses, did he have much of a God orientation? We don't know for sure if he had much of one before this. He has had a great tradition in his family way back. And they had been 400 years in Egypt. God had brought them then. But they had begun to not only be forgotten about who they were, but they began to forget who God was. And here we don't find a God orientation necessarily in Moses' life. But he sees this bush. And out of it says his name, Moses, Moses. And he says, okay, if something's going on here, here I am. And all of a sudden, I think at this point, Moses' life began to change. Because he began to respond to the voice of God. And he says, here I am. Now look at this in verse 5. Let's circle it. It's a big deal. And then God said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy ground, Moses. What's about to happen here, Moses, is unique. What's about to go on here is my presence. Take off your sandals. This is holy ground. You're engaging the holy God of the universe. And I'm sure Moses began to think, oh my gosh, something just happened. Just think about it. He is now 80 years old. He's been in the desert for 40 years. I don't know about you, but I began to wonder, didn't he begin to wonder, how did this happen in my life? First 40 years, he lived in Pharaoh's home. And for the next 40 years, he is a lost soul in the wilderness of Midian. And now he is out shepherding sheep all by himself. And life had kind of passed him by. Life hadn't turned out quite like he had expected, I think. I don't know, the other day the elders and I, we sat down and we talked about how life has not turned out quite like we thought it would. You know, we all have a picture of what our life would look like. And we're kind of frustrated when it doesn't turn out that way. In fact, sometimes we get downright angry. We get very bitter about the way life turns out. Either this went wrong, or that went wrong, or those people did me wrong, or I did those people wrong, or whatever. And here he is, all by himself in the middle of a desert, shepherding sheep. Are you kidding me? He'd been in Pharaoh's house. He'd had the best of everything. He'd had an incredible life. And then he makes a mistake, a big mistake. He kills an Egyptian, and he runs. And for 40 years, he's alone. He gets a wife, he has a family, but life wasn't quite like what I think he expected. And then, look at here in verse 6. And he says then, this is what God says to him, I am the God of your father. I am the God of your background. I am the God that you've heard about, but don't know much about. That's who I am. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And then Moses hid his face and he was afraid to look at God. He began to understand what was going on, that this is an awesome and holy God, one that he didn't know much about, hadn't engaged very much, and all of a sudden God begins to deal with him. And he hides his face, he understands his brokenness, he understands the inadequacy of his own life, I think. And he was afraid. And you know, sometimes we'd like to say that we ought not to be afraid of God. And on the most part, I agree with that. But there is a portion of that that's not true. That God is an awesome God. He is a fearful God. He is an infinite God. He is a holy God. And I don't need to be afraid because he's so mean. I need to be concerned because I'm so not holy, right? I'm not. But he is. And so he was afraid to look at God. And then look at this in verse 7. He says, "Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people." This is incredible. Here's this personalness of God, right? We talked about God being infinite and yet being personal. Here's the deal. "And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of the taskmasters." And then I want to circle this. "I know their suffering." I know their sufferings. I don't know where you're at today, but I have a feeling you could probably list some things that are not perfect, that are hard, that feel like suffering, that feel difficult, that tear at your heart and at your soul, that you worry about and you hurt about and you're sad about. You have those things. We all do. They did. And I think that there's something unique here about this God. He says that he knows their suffering. I think that God knows where you're going through. And in fact, he cares about it. Deep down, he cares so much about your suffering. The verse goes on in verse 8, "And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land, to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and all these ites that are there. I'm going to bring you into the land. I've got something for you. I have a plan for you. I have a future for you. In the midst of your suffering, don't quit. Don't give up. Know that I'm there." Wow. Look at verse 9 then. "And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel had come to me, and I've also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them." And then he says, "Come, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." Wow. Now, you guys, look at this in verse 11. "But," big but, right? All of a sudden, here's this incredible thing happening. And what is Moses' response? He ought to be saying, "Yeah, hot diggity, let's get after it, let's roll." Well, here's what he says. "But Moses says to God, well, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Egypt out of Egypt? Who am I?" And I want to say, what do you mean, who are you? If there's anybody that has had that position as a Hebrew, no one has had that position in Egypt, nobody but you. What do you mean, who are you? You're the natural one. Are you kidding me? Stop being such a weasel. Don't be, you know, whoa, poor as me. Oh, who am I to do this? You kidding me? You're the natural choice. It has been 40 years. Most people have forgotten about him at this point. But he had an incredible position. But really, that's not what it's about, right? It doesn't really matter if he was so influential or not. Look at this. Look at the response. I love this. God almost ignores him, in a sense. Look at verse 12. And God says, and he says, "But I'll be with you, Moses." You see, it doesn't matter who you are, Moses. "I will be with you." Wow. "And this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." I think it's amazing. He goes, "Hey, here's the deal. I'm going to be with you. And when you go get them," almost assuming it's going to happen, right? He's just expecting it's going to happen. "Moses, I'm going to be with you. I will accomplish this. And the sign will be that when you come back out and come back to this mountain, we're going to worship God. You're going to worship together." Because he is with him. Not because Moses is so slick. Because he's not, right? Eventually we find that he says, "I'm not very good speaking." And God goes like, "Oh, whatever. Okay, I'll get your brother to speak for you." I mean, he's like, come up with every excuse in the world. But he says, "I'm with you." So in the midst of that suffering, in the midst of his plan, God is with him. I don't know about you, but probably that's what we all need, right, in our lives, is the sense that God is with me. In the midst of the suffering, in the midst of the difficulty, in the midst of our weakness, in the midst of our inadequacies, that God is with us. And we don't have to trump it up. We don't have to kind of act like we're so spiritual. We're not. God is with us. God will be present. And you can trust him. And you say, okay, I'm going to keep walking. Wow, it's incredible. That's what happens here. Now look in verse 13. And then Moses said to God, kind of like, well, okay, maybe. Okay, I got some questions here, you know, kind of thing. So he says, if I come to the people of Israel, who I haven't seen in 40 years, right? Okay, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, well, what's his name? What shall we say to them? It's a really natural question because all the gods of Egypt had names, right? They all have names. They do different things. They all have different relationships with each other. There are hundreds of gods in Egypt, some of the River Nile, some of animals, some of the weather, some of love. There are all sorts of gods, and they all have names, okay? And so they go, well, they're going to ask, what's this God's name? And so then God says to Moses, here's my name. I am who I am. It comes from the Hebrew verb hayah, which means to be. You see, I am the God who simply is. I always have been, I am, and I always will be. I am the one who fills corner to corner of the world, of the universe. I am the one who simply exists, and I self-exist. I need nothing beyond me. I don't need you. I don't need anything. I created all this in a word. I just spoke it, and it happened. That's who I am. I am that I am. I am who I am. I do what I do. I will do what I want to do. I am the full and awesome God of the whole universe. That's who I am. I am that I am. Wow. Then he continues, and he says this, and say to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. It's the word Yahweh. It's not a brand new word to the Hebrew. They understood it a little bit. It was kind of in their background religiously. This name that's almost, it's just four consonants. It's no vowels in it. We add vowels to try to pronounce it. But it's this incredible name of the presence of God, Yahweh, from which we change it to get Jehovah. But it's Yahweh. It comes from this verb, hayah, to be. His presence is everything. Wow, that's incredible. And then God also says to Moses in verse 15, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. And then let's box this. This is my name forever, and thus I shall be remembered throughout all generations. That's us. That's us. You see, the God that we know, the God who offers himself to us, is the God who is. He is. He just is. He is the God who gives us life and breath and in whom we have our being. He is a God who is bigger and more awesome than we ever dreamed, than we can ever even picture. He is more beautiful than anything you've ever seen, more awesome than anything you've ever experienced. And that's the God who loves you. And that is the name that he will be known forever. So let me just kind of wrap up with this. I think there are several things here. First of all, it is important and it is reasonable that we ask the question of God, who are you? It almost seems arrogant, doesn't it? But we ought to ask the question, God, who are you really? But here's the problem. We're going to have to be willing to live with the answer. We like to ask the question. We don't really like the answer. That's kind of our culture. We want to keep asking the question. But when we get the answer, he says, I am the great I am. I am the one who is and has always been and will always be. I am the one who made you, and in fact, I own you. You are mine, and you've been stolen, and I want you back. It's a good question, God, who are you? But we have to be ready to respond to his answer and give our lives to that. Secondly, it's probably a good question for us to ask. It's reasonable to ask the question, who am I then? Who am I? Because I exist. I matter. You matter. Who are you? And maybe here's the bottom line. It seems to me that who God is determines the essential ingredients and defines our identity because his presence changes everything. You see, you can never answer who you are until you answer the question or until he answers the question of who he is, because who he is determines who we are. And not in a bad way. We feel like that constricts us. Well, you go, I want to be bigger than that. I want to be more profound than that. I want to do different things than that. And the problem is that that's a lie, and that everything that we've ever done this begins to destroy the image of God when we do it on our own. It destroys what God wanted in our lives. It's amazing. So this God that we serve, here's who he is. He is, I am who I am. I am that I am. I have done what I have done. I will do what I will do. I am self-existent one. I am the infinite one. I am the personal one. I am the redemptive one. I am the one in whom you live and breathe and have your being. I am the one who made you. I am the one who loves you. That is who I am. And in that, you will find out who you are as a person. And this summer, we're going to spend a whole summer talking about when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the bright and morning star. I am, and he begins to take on the mantle of who God is in revealing who he is and the depth of who he is in our lives. And so this summer should be a great time for us to begin to know who God is, because I'm pretty convinced of this. If we could understand who God is, if people living down the street who have never heard the name of Jesus could begin to understand who God actually is, that they would give their hearts to him, because he is more beautiful than they ever heard or ever knew, and that we're going to get to live that out with them. So this morning, as we take communion, what I would like you to do is to come with a heart of saying, I come to give my life to the great I am, the one who gave his body on a cross broken for me, who shed his blood for me, to die for you. So if you're here this morning and you're a believer in Jesus, this is a place for you to come. There's only two people who probably this would be inappropriate. Is if you're not a believer, if this isn't something that's real in your life, go ahead and skip. It's okay. It's not embarrassing in any way. The only other group of people that the scriptures tell us is if you're out of fellowship with God and you're at war with him and not willing to deal with him, he says, don't do this at this point. Wait till your heart is in the right place. And so I'd encourage you not to take in a way that maybe would violate where you're really at with God. Sometimes we're at war with him, pushing back, don't want anything to do with it. So I'd encourage you. But other than that, to come and to participate. So why don't the band come up? And if you're serving communion, why don't you come and take your positions? But I just want you to prepare yourself this first morning that we're here to celebrate and worship Christ, the great I am, the one who is, the one who was and is and will always be, and the one who you are the object of his love. You are the object of his affections. And you might come. So prepare yourself for a moment here as we pray, and then I'll call us forward.